Tomorrow faces charges that he attempted to lead a coup to stay in power. The Justice Department is reviewing misconduct accusations against officials who investigated Russian election interference, including former directors of the FBI and CIA. Alaska's rural energy providers say Trump's budget cuts critical support for renewable power, leaving remote communities stuck with expensive diesel fuel. Pierre Lone Wolf with the Kotzebue Electric Association Power Co-op says their projects would have lowered bills.
That has put the kibosh on our wind project, which we are partnering with the local tribe to install 2 more 1-megawatt wind turbines and another megawatt or so of solar.
Alaska's Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski supported the mega bill after securing funding for tribal whale hunters and modest renewable carve-outs. Organizers across the Dakotas and Mountain West want to help everyday people enter public service. Gwen Lackalt with the Western Organization of Resource Councils says the strategy is already paying off.
In 2024, we saw 12 seats that were flipped in the state of Montana by your very ordinary Montanan.
I'm Farah Siddiqui.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Hannah Francis, and James Kemp. The producer's Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The interim evening news director is Hannah Francis. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks for joining us. All our KBOO programs are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth, up next.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. Here are today's top stories. In the war in Ukraine, Russian attacks intensify, Trump is finally getting upset with Putin, and Russian violations of international law are piling up. Netanyahu visits Washington, but is another ceasefire possible? And the Trump tariff squeeze is back on. First, the war in Ukraine. Russia is carrying out some of the most intense drone and missile attacks of the war. Trump keeps having conversations with Putin that lead not to sanctions, but to mounting disapproval of Russian actions. More weapons for Ukraine seem to be off the table. Now they're back on. Various news sources had reported that Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth had halted weapons shipments to Ukraine 3 times on the false argument that stockpiles had been dangerously depleted. In fact, a review of the stockpiles by the Joint Staff concluded that providing continued assistance to Ukraine would not drain U.S. supplies below a required threshold needed to ensure military readiness. Moreover, Hegseth did not advise anyone in Congress, Ukraine, or the European Union about these suspended deliveries, which were on their way from Poland before being turned back. The weapons involved, which include Patriot interceptors to shoot down missiles, are crucial to Ukraine's defense. A number of Republicans complained to the Pentagon about the deliveries. In the past, they helped bring about a reversal of Hegseth's decision. Maybe it has worked again, or maybe it was because Trump is becoming increasingly annoyed with Putin. Trump said, quote, "I'm not happy with President Putin at all," following the latest Russian attacks on Kyiv. "We get a lot of BS thrown at us by Putin," said Trump, "if you want to know the truth. He's very nice to us all the time, but it turns out to be meaningless." Trump said he didn't know who ordered the pause in weapon shipments to Ukraine, and then reversed gears, saying Monday that Ukraine was being hit very, very hard, and he announced, "We're going to send some more weapons." If you're a Ukrainian, you have to wonder what this latest shift means. Which weapons? How many? When delivered? These weapons, I should point out, are part of a U.S. military aid program under Joe Biden. Trump has not proposed any new weapons bill since taking office. No new money for Ukraine is in the latest budget bill he just approved. Adding to the list of Russian aggressive actions is charges from the Netherlands and Germany about Russian use of chemical weapons in Ukraine. Previously, Russian forces had employed tear gas. Now they are accused of using chloropicrin, a much more powerful chemical agent. In an official statement, quote, "The Netherlands Defense Intelligence and Security Service, the Netherlands General Intelligence and Security Service, and the German Foreign Intelligence Service warn that Russia's use of chemical weapons in Ukraine is intensifying. This is a violation of the Chemical Weapons Convention." The Dutch defense minister said Russia is using a wide range of chemical weapons with increasing frequency and is not hesitating to employ more potent weapons such as chloropicrin. He said this is a slippery slope. "We are drawing public attention to this now because the employment of chemical weapons by Russia must not be normalized. Lowering the threshold for the use of this type of weapon poses a danger not only to Ukraine, but also to the rest of Europe and the world. This calls for more sanctions, the isolation of Russia, and undiminished military support for Ukraine," unquote. In a new development on the legal side, the Council of Europe, which is comprised of the 27 EU countries and 19 other European nations, has established a special tribunal for the crime of aggression against Ukraine. Though Vladimir Putin has been found guilty by the International Criminal Court of war crimes for the abduction of children, and there is a warrant out for his arrest, the crime of aggression does not fall under the International Criminal Court or, until now, any other court. Unlike war crimes and crimes against humanity, aggression is exclusively a leadership crime. Only top policymakers can commit it. The new court will have 15 judges elected by the Council of Europe. Another court under the Council, the European Court of Human Rights, has just found Russia guilty of four additional crimes. The shooting down of a Malaysian airliner in 2014 that killed 298 passengers and, quote, "widespread and flagrant abuses of human rights in Ukraine since 2014, including summary executions, torture, rape, looting, and the transfer to Russia and, in many cases, the adoption there of Ukrainian children." Next, Netanyahu visits Washington, but is another ceasefire possible? President Trump had hoped that Prime Minister Netanyahu would bring with him assuring words about a ceasefire with Hamas. But neither Israel nor Hamas has budged from previous positions. Nor has Trump budged from his usual public optimism and private unwillingness to pressure Israel. Thus, we have Netanyahu determined to eliminate Hamas as a player in Gaza's future, and Hamas determined to get a commitment to a permanent truce. These long-standing positions obscure each side's claim to being interested in resuming a ceasefire. But Netanyahu is a master at playing U.S. presidents. He announced that he was nominating Trump for the Nobel Peace Prize. Israeli forces have done nothing to encourage a positive response from Hamas to a ceasefire. As I have reported, the Israeli Defense Forces are again attacking Gaza City, forcing Palestinians to flee once more. The food situation in much of Gaza is desperate. The distribution plan for food aid is itself a cause of many deaths that are occurring as people line up for food. The new relief organization developed by U.S. advisors in Israel, called the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, brings Gazans in close proximity with the IDF. A UN agency has warned that, according to the Washington Post, that crowd control could lead to violence. More than 400 people have been killed in this situation. Reportedly, Hamas's interest in a ceasefire depends on how three issues are addressed by Israel. How aid would enter Gaza during the truce? Hamas wants the UN and the Palestinian Red Crescent to administer aid. how far Israeli forces would withdraw from positions in Gaza, and whether the United States and Arab countries will guarantee that a permanent ceasefire holds. Israel has so far rejected all these conditions. While the parties maneuver, the death toll in Gaza rises. It's now around 57,000 civilian and military. The number of live hostages dwindles, still believed to be about 20. And Israel is reportedly planning to move a large number of Palestinians to the border area with Egypt. The Trump tariff squeeze is back on. In Trump's trade war, Canada is showing it has options for its energy exports. The Times reports on the voyage of a tanker loaded with liquefied natural gas that is headed to South Korea from British Columbia. It's the first natural gas shipment from a major Canadian plant to Asia, as Canada looks to diversify its export markets in the aftermath of Trump's trade war and annexation threats. Trump is set to impose another round of stiff tariffs as his July 9 deadline approaches. Canada, South Korea, and Japan have all been threatened, Trump's notion of diplomacy, though given until August 1 to react to a 25% tariff rate. Several other countries, including South Africa and Malaysia, were informed that they face 40% tariffs. The BRICS group, which includes Brazil and Russia, about 13 in all, are being threatened with an additional 10% tariff if they adopt, quote-unquote, anti-American policies. Trump apparently had in mind statements from the group at its annual summit meeting in Brazil that criticized unilaterally imposed tariffs and the U.S. attack on Iran. This is the second time Trump has threatened the BRICS. The first occurred when the BRICS countries discussed adopting their own currency for transactions in place of the U.S. dollar. But nothing came of Trump's threat to impose a 100% tariff on BRICS goods. Trump's press secretary offered a laughable remark when she said the new tariffs are, quote, in the best interest of the American people. All the evidence, rising prices, stagflation risks, disrupted supply chains, unemployment, show otherwise. Yet the secretary insists Trump's phone, quote, rings off the hook from world leaders all the time who are begging him to come to a deal. Actually, some insider accounts suggest that it is Trump who is begging some countries to conclude a deal. Since April 2nd, all that ringing has produced three tentative trade agreements. In other news, Trump's compact with El Salvador's leader gives new life to MS-13. Donald Trump promised to eradicate the notorious transnational gang MS-13. This is the gang Kilmer Abrego Garcia is accused of being part of, one reason for his unlawful deportation to El Salvador. But the leader of the gang, Vladimir Arevalo Chavez, who was arrested in February 2023 in the U.S., has been returned to El Salvador, along with other MS-13 leaders, as part of a previously unknown deal between the Trump administration and El Salvador's president, Nayib Bukele. So why did Bukele want these gangsters returned? A New York Times investigation has found that a corrupt pact existed between the Salvadoran government and some MS-13 leaders, quote, who agreed to drive down violence and bolster Bukele politically in exchange for cash and perks in jail. Bukele was elected in large part on the basis of bringing down crime. So far from eradicating MS-13, which the Justice Department designates as a foreign terrorist organization, Trump abetted the gang and undermined ongoing U.S. investigation of it. Moreover, Trump cut the deal with a Salvadoran government that is authoritarian and runs one of the world's most oppressive prisons. But there's more. The Trump administration has contended for months that it cannot gain the return of the Venezuelans like Abrego Garcia, who were deported to El Salvador because the prisoners are under the control of El Salvador. But just the other day, in a court hearing here, the judge discovered that for the past 3 months, the administration has had in hand a clear statement from the Salvadoran government that the U.S., not El Salvador, controls the fate of the prisoners. Concealment of that document might cause the entire deportation case to unravel. North Korea's Kim Jong-un mourns losses in Ukraine. It was a rare event, the North Korean leader mourning battlefield losses on live TV. According to South Korean sources, North Korean units have so far lost 600 soldiers and suffered 4,700 casualties in actions in Ukraine. Kim used the ceremony, which also marked the first anniversary of the North Korea-Russia Mutual Defense Treaty, to note how North Korea has sacrificed in support of Russia. The TV audience was shown images for the first time of North Korean soldiers fighting in Ukraine. Russia says that North Korea has pledged an additional 6,000 troops, consisting of military construction workers and combat engineers. Trump wades into Brazil's politics and gets called out. It figures that a president who should have been tried and convicted of inciting a coup would support another country's president who did the same. The difference is that in Brazil, Jair Bolsonaro will be tried for attempting a coup following the 2022 election, whereas Donald Trump got off scot-free. Trump has come to Bolsonaro's defense with the usual charge of witch hunt. Bolsonaro is barred from seeking office for 8 years, but Trump's intervention supports Bolsonaro's insistence he will run for president in 2026. Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, Brazil's current president, who defeated Bolsonaro, lectured Trump, quote, "This country has laws, rules, and a boss called the Brazilian people. Give your opinion on your life and not ours," said Lula. Finally, global warming is speeding up. Global warming is not just getting worse every year, it is worsening at a faster pace. A report published last week found that human-caused global warming is now increasing by 0.27 degrees Celsius per decade, compared with 0.2 degrees in the 1970s. That may seem like an insignificant increase, but Daniel Swain, a climate scientist at the University of California, says, quote, "Each additional fractional degree of warming brings about a relatively larger increase in atmospheric extremes, like extreme downpours and severe droughts and wildfires," unquote. Thus, glaciers are melting faster, heat records are being set every year, and sea surface temperatures are rising much faster than predicted. Most worrisome, says another climate scientist, is, quote, "how the general nature of clouds may be changing in response to climbing temperatures. It's a feedback loop that could potentially exacerbate warming and is, quote, one of the single biggest uncertainties in predicting future climate." This news comes as the Trump administration is hiring 3 climate change deniers to replace scientists who had been working on the issue. The 3 have impeccable conservative credentials and ties to the energy industry. The Times reports that, quote, "their hiring comes after the Trump administration dismissed hundreds of scientists and experts who had been compiling the federal government's flagship report on how climate change is affecting the country. The administration has also systematically removed mentions of climate change from government websites while slashing federal funding for research on global warming," unquote. And that's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening and take good care.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Hannah Francis. I have with me Snowden intern reporter Grace Mangali. Today, we are talking about Mangali's story, End of Metro Affordable Housing Bond Worries Advocates. With available funding nearly gone, the future is unclear for publicly funded affordable housing projects in the Portland area. Thanks for being here with me, Grace.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Absolutely, yeah. So folks are worried about the fact that this housing bond is almost all used up. Exactly how used up is it?
It's about 87% allocated right now, but all of the funds are tied to a specific housing project, and the rest of those housing projects are intended to be breaking ground in 2026. So, you know, they'll be built up, and that's about the end of it.
So give me an idea of what some of this funding is going to.
Yeah, so a majority of, well, actually all of the Metro Housing Bond money goes towards the construction of apartment buildings that are designated for folks making under 60% of the area median income, or AMI. And there's this kind of perception that folks making over 60%, like about 60 to 80%, are the ones that are in need of affordable housing, when in reality, the folks that need affordable housing the most are the people that are transitioning out of homelessness. So that is people that need, you know, wraparound services, need their entire rent subsidized. And that is what the money is going towards, is building those houses. And then the Supportive Housing Services Act, which is also sunsetting in 2030, was paying for, you know, rent subsidies and those wraparound services. And so the Metro Housing Bond really prioritized the folks that needed that affordable housing the most.
Tell me a little about this specific example that you use in your article, Portland's Hattie Redmond Apartments. What's that like?
I had the opportunity to go there and talk to some wonderful folks. A lot of them did work for with Urban League, and you know, a lot of the sources, out of their own security, decided to remain anonymous. But there was a lot of overlap there. I talked to some folks that worked at a shelter right down the street that was also an Urban League project, and you know, they're really kind of understanding of the situation that, you know, people who are transitioning out of homelessness need permanent housing. They don't need to be shuffled from shelter to shelter. They don't need to be kind of constantly going from one place to another. The most, you know, effective way of getting people off of the streets is providing them with housing. And so this specific apartment, I think it was about $4.4 million that the Metro Housing Bond contributed to them. And this housing actually had all of the units available were available to folks making under 60% of the AMI. And it also is in a historically Black neighborhood in Portland, and had services for people dealing with disabilities. And so they were really, really reliant on that money, and also the money from the Supportive Housing Services Act, to keep going. And so they were just expressing a lot of concern and uncertainty. That was kind of the main feeling from a lot of the folks that I talked to, was just, it's kind of up in the air where this money will be coming from in the future. And if that service is not provided for people, permanent housing, you know, we can get people to shelters and we can get people to have temporary services, but the longevity of their success is just way less likely.
Right. Yeah. So what exactly happened to this Metro Housing Bond?
It essentially, they, you know, raised all this money through this tax, and it just got, you know, entirely allocated, entirely used up, in the, because it's really expensive to construct and build, you know, housing from the ground up. I know a last bit of it is going into this city acquisition model, which is where they're kind of taking already built, you know, former hotels, former like other buildings that they were able to purchase because the market value was lower, and converting those into permanent housing, which I think is something that they're kind of, you know, Metro and the city and the county are kind of thinking of shifting towards, because it's just easier in some cases, and then in some cases it's not. So yeah, the money is just, it's just being used up. It did what it was supposed to do. And the real challenge is that there's just nothing after it that's going to replace it.
Are there any moves to do this again?
During my research, it was definitely still up in the air, but they decided to not re-up the bond. It pulled very like disfavorably for Metro when they kind of proposed doing another housing bond. Another thing to know is also there was recently a zoo bond passed, so you know, people cared enough to vote to have a bond for the zoo. And so after this Metro Housing Bond, like, they knew it was going to happen, and some Metro was kind of considering using funds from the Supportive Housing Services Act, but it just, that money is not enough. I had one source tell me, like, if you do less with less, less gets done, because it was just not enough money to fund construction, subsidize rent, and also provide services. So, you know, right now it's really up in the air. We know that the city is kind of shifting towards, and federally, we're shifting towards a very shelter heavy model of not very housing first model, which is proven over and over again to be a less effective form of getting rid of homelessness.
Yeah, tell me about that a little bit more, that shift to shelter first.
Yeah, so, you know, our mayor pledged to end unsheltered homelessness by December 1st of this year. And that just included kind of building, 1,500 shelter beds. However, the issue with these shelters is you can go for a night or you can go for a day and you can get what you need to get through the next 24 hours. But the issue is we're just like, it's perpetuating a cycle of going to a shelter and ending up back on the street, going to a shelter, ending up back on the street. When in reality, those shelters can be very effective and be very great and very helpful in the step of getting people out of homelessness if there is a permanent shelter to then direct them to then have them apply to and, you know, provide the services that is available for them. And I know, you know, our president is talking about moving these people to like dormitory style compounds in the middle of nowhere, because I think that a lot of people in power are very focused on quickly getting this done when in reality it's an issue that has been going on for decades, if not centuries. It's embedded in our systems, it's embedded in our housing system, it's embedded in our economy. And so I think not looking at it as a reactive problem, I know that like we've been in a state of emergency for 2 years now, that's been extended to 2026, and it is an emergency and we should be treating it as such. However, long term, the solution is long term affordable housing. I hope that answered your question.
Yeah, absolutely, well said. How many unhoused people are there in Portland right now?
Right now in Portland, according to March 2025 data, about 15,000 people are experiencing homelessness in Multnomah County, and about a little bit over half are unsheltered, which means people who do not have, you know, somewhere to sleep. So a lot of homeless people could be like couch surfing or could be spending times at shelters or motel shelters. But a lot of those people are just on the streets.
Right. So what are some hopes for what will happen next?
Yeah, so Street Roots actually did recently in our paper last week report about this social housing model that they've developed, that the city of Portland has devoted money and resource to researching. And so this is essentially when like the people who live in an apartment building have a say in what happens in it and have a say in how much they're paying. And it's a really great article and I would recommend reading that for solutions. This acquisition model has a quicker turnaround time largely because they don't need to construct new buildings. It does have some issues in terms of like spatial awareness and like how much like space they need for the services that they provide. And also Metro did, they had a huge focus on equity. So they partnered with, you know, the people that were largely going to be living in these spaces to make them just livable and breathable and suitable for the communities it was representing. Other than that, yeah, the social housing model. Other than that, we're just kind of waiting to see how this temporary shelter thing works out. And in the meantime, I think it would be, you know, in the best interest to just continue funding affordable housing in the city and focusing it on the people that are not having any rent, not the people that are having trouble finding housing, the people that truly cannot find housing.
Yeah. I'm curious, where do pod villages fall sort of on that spectrum of like shelter versus affordable housing?
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of the same thing where it's temporary. I think that like a largely like shelters innately, which I think can be a little bit of a misconception, shelters are not innately ineffective. It's when shelters are the only option, they're ineffective. So it's same thing with pod villages. It's the same thing with motel shelters. It's the same thing when, you know, you're having people kind of save up and be able to stay place for a couple of days. But then if you're not providing them, you know, a resource, they're going to end up back on the streets, and then that system's going to perpetuate. And it's the same thing for the city. It costs $52,000 to support one shelter bed for a year. So when we're thinking about just what the best place to use our money is, it's going to be a long time before we truly kind of reap the rewards of having all this affordable housing. But long term, that in my research and talking to people that work with for nonprofits, like that is what everyone believes is going to be the solution to homelessness in Portland and everywhere else.
Yeah. 52,000 mm-hmm. sounds like a great wage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's pretty rough to see that spent like that, but also, you know, shelter is important. It's just, yeah, mm-hmm. like you're saying, it should not be the only option.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to get out there about your article?
You know, I had a privilege to talk to people who have lived in affordable housing centers, and housing really can be a lifeline. I think that, you know, when you have somewhere to live and somewhere to go home to and somewhere to store your belongings, that's just a huge thing off your plate. And I think, you know, housing is a human right and people should have access to it. And it's in everyone's best interest to think about long-term structural change that will long-term help the people who live in the city. And that is what I would like to say.
And where can folks find this article?
In a paper that a Shooter's vendor is probably selling. You can come into our office on Monday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday on Burnside. And we have new resource guides being printed that you can also pick up at the office. So please feel free to do that.
You're listening to KBOO News in Depth.
You are tuned into KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
By some hole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down, and I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Tune in to KBOO Monday mornings at 9.